So I'm going to start this lecture with a movie. Hopefully you'll be really impressed with my artistic abilities, and hopefully you won't understand what the movie is about. And then what I will do is teach you everything you need to know in order to understand what's going on, and then I'll play it again at the end. So we'll see how that goes. And just a caveat, this was made 6 years ago, when I was procrastinating during my PhD. And this is before we had HD, so there are a lot of pixels in the video. Jeez. this guy's, did she say 16 years ago? I look great for my age, right?
I thought you were a child prodigy.
Yeah.
Like doing PhD when you were like six.
Or you just... Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so let me play. I've never seen this on big screen before. It's not even funny. Okay, was everyone impressed? Yeah.
It needs music.
It does have music.
Oh.
But I didn't play the music because people find it distracting. So the music is by... I'll play it again at the end, okay? And we'll play it with music. So it's by a Brisbane band called Regurgitator. They're awesome. They're awesome. Okay, so I guess, yeah, can we have the screen up, please, Max? Okay, so the things that you saw in the movie, they were different types of quantum optical states. And so in this lecture, I'm going to start off with showing you how we quantize the electromagnetic field, and then I'll introduce a lot of the states that we saw in the movie, and then I'll show you how we can use this Wigner function to represent these quantum states of light in pretty movies. So, so a nice place to start this discussion is to use the classical field equations, and then we can quantize the field from there. So let's write down Maxwell's equations. Actually, I'm just going to drop the hats and we can assume they're all vectors. Not hats, arrows. And so these are the equations for the free field where we have no source. And they're gauge invariant. And so a convenient choice for quantum optics is the Coulomb gauge, which we're going to apply. Where this operator A is the vector A is the vector potential, and we can define the magnetic and electric fields in terms of this vector potential A. And then we can use a subset of these equations, combine them all together, and rewrite the wave equation for the vector potential. And then the next step on the way to quantizing the field is to separate this vector potential into what we call the positive and negative frequency components. So we can write A of RT in terms of a positive, well, I'm going to say something that has a plus on it, and something that has a minus. And A plus or minus of RT contains contains amplitudes that vary with e to the minus plus I omega t. So actually, this is the negative frequency component, and that's the positive frequency component, which is kind of confusing. But it's because this has like the positive momentum component in it. Okay, so now it's much more convenient to deal with discrete modes rather than continuous modes. And so usually we assume that we've got some sort of volume, and we're going to quantize the field inside this volume. Was this board working? Did Neil have trouble with
it? That one's not.
Okay, so let's see what happens. Okay, so we're going to restrict the field to be in some sort of volume. And then we can expand the vector potential in terms of mode functions. So I put a little arrow on that to show that that thing is a vector. And so I'm not going to go into the details of what these look like. They're going to depend on what sort of volume you start off with. They're going to depend on the boundary conditions and all of that. But for the moment, we're just going to worry about the properties that that these mode functions satisfy. Okay, so the mode functions satisfy the wave equation. They satisfy the transversality condition, and they also form an orthonormal set. And then once we do that, we can rewrite the vector potential in terms of these mode functions.
So, Aggie, where do the yes. second two conditions, or the third condition I can see, where's the second condition come from?
So that is the transversality, I can't say the word, transversality condition.
So it's zero?
Off the top of my head, I'm not going to see how to derive it. Yeah, off the top of my head, I can't say. But we can look at it like this afternoon.
The transversality for the mode function?
Yeah.
Isn't that manifestation of the gauge?
Yeah, I think it looks like it comes from the Coulomb.
It comes from the gauge fixing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys probably know about gauge fixing much better than I do.
I think that it just comes from the Coulomb gauge.
Okay. So Vasudev says it comes from the Coulomb gauge fixing. Excellent. Okay, great. So now we can write the vector potential in terms of the mode functions. And then from that, we can figure out the corresponding electric field. And we can also do it for the magnetic field. But in quantum optics, we don't really think about magnetic fields. So I'll just stick with the electric field. What do I want to say about that? OK, so okay, so in classical electromagnetic theory, these Fourier components, they're just going to be complex numbers. But when we quantize the field, we take these to be operators that satisfy specific commutation relations. And so make quantum. We're going to, ultimately we're going to be talking about photons, which are bosons, so we're going to enforce that they satisfy the bosonic commutation relations. want to phrase it like that. And so these operators, these things now have been promoted to operators, and they're analogous to, do I want to say that yet? Maybe I don't want to say that yet. Okay, I will make this comment in a minute. But I mean, they should look quite familiar to you. Okay, great. So now we have our electric field in terms of these operators, and using, yes,
can you get those from some kind of Poisson brackets?
I don't know how to answer that question. Shall we open it up? Can you get it from some kind of Poisson bracket?
Yeah. This A and E are canonically conjugate to each other. And if you write A and E in the, using the Mohr decomposition, then the Poisson brackets for A and E will imply those Poisson brackets for A and E.
But I mean, like,
big A and big E are canonically conjugate to each other in this case. And then A0 is the branch multiplier with the Gauss law constraint being the constraint. And then the commutation relations, the Poisson bracket relations for A and E imply for A hat and, you know, A dagger, these things. It's very much.
So they Poisson brackets in terms of K then? Like,
huh?
Are they Poisson brackets in terms of K then? Like, E by DK? Are they Poisson brackets in terms of K? Because those aren't functions of X.
It doesn't matter. It's Fourier transform to Fourier transform between A and K. It's between A and E, so it's like K or A of X, right?
Oh, okay. Right. Yep.
Good. So short answer, yes. Yes? Great. Okay, and so then the next thing that we're interested in is writing down the Hamiltonian for the electromagnetic field. And so this, you can see, looks just like the classical energy for the field. And if we now substitute our expressions for the quantized field, where is it? Yeah. And also the one that you would write down for the magnetic field, you can rewrite it in a very nice way. And so then you can see that we can think of the electromagnetic field as just a whole bunch of uncoupled harmonic oscillators, which makes calculations very nice. Okay. And so we can think of this thing, we'll kind of come to it later, but we can think of this as the number operator. And so then you can see that the total energy is going to be a sum of all of the all of the photons multiplied by the energy of the photon. And then we've got this extra h bar omega k half term, which corresponds to the energy of the vacuum. Okay, great. So let's see. No, okay. Okay, so now that we've got the Hamiltonian, we can move on to looking at some states of the electromagnetic field. I don't know if this is as funny in like K Canadian as it is in Australian. But, but like, this led to a lot of very funny jokes during my PhD. Anyway. Okay, so Fock states. So we can look at the Hamiltonian and we can calculate its eigenvalues and eigenvectors. And so we see that the Hamiltonian has eigenvalues of h bar omega k, n k plus a half, where n k is an integer, and the eigenstates are typically written like this. And they are what we refer to as Fock states or number states. And these, the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, well, actually the tensor product of all of these for different k's are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. But for an individual k, they are also eigenstates of the number operator. So the number operator tells you how many photons you have in a particular state. And we can use this to calculate the energy of the ground state. Oh, hang on, I haven't defined. So the ground state is defined by the annihilation operator acting on, when the annihilation operator acts on the ground state, it just disappears. And so this is all very analogous to the harmonic oscillator that we did in the previous the lectures at the beginning of the program. Okay, so I've kind of already been using the language, but these operators, they're the raising and lowering operators that you're familiar with, but in quantum optics, we use the terminology annihilation and creation operators. Because they correspond to the creation of a photon or the annihilation of a photon in the field. Yes, Dylan.
Is there a subscript on the number operator?
Yes.
So there are different ones?
Right. So here, yeah. So because the we've got a discrete set of modes that the electromagnetic field is written, is decomposed into, then for each mode, we've got a separate number operator and, you know, a separate Hilbert space. So the entire Hilbert space of the electromagnetic field is the tensor product of all of the different k's, essentially, labels k. But, like, for simplicity, often we just work in a single mode picture where we just, you know, pick one certain k and then, like, deal with that. So just to give you a like a physical example, I could have so depending on how you you know which volume you pick, but the k could refer to as the momentum or the you know frequency of the photon, and it also corresponds to the polarization. So I could have a state like this that's 2k1, 3k2. And this might mean that I have a 2-photon Fock state that's red and horizontally polarized, and a 3-photon Fock state that's blue and vertically polarized. So the K is a subscript that refers to some sort of physical property of the state. Okay, and there's a very bad joke you can make about these operators, which I'm not going to do because last year I did it and then I got embarrassed and I got them to cut it out. So ask me for the joke in the tutorial. okay. Right, so I think what I was saying is you're used to these annihilation, lowering and raising operators, and here we call them annihilation and creation operators because they annihilate and create photons in the field. And we can use these operators to define all of the number states, well, to transition between number states as follows. So a creation operator on an n photon state gives you an n minus 1 photon state. Sorry, annihilation operator. And creation operator on an n photon state gives you an n plus 1 photon state. And we can also apply these operators successively to the vacuum state to define the Fock state. So applying the operator n times to the vacuum state gives you back the n photon Fock state. Okay, I only have a couple of more things to write about these guys. So yeah, just to finish off on the Fock states, they're orthogonal and they are complete. So. So we have the resolution of identity, which comes in, I mean, you've seen already in all of the calculations, it helps to have an expression for the identity that you can stick in and manipulate your expressions with. So that's the equivalent for the Fock bases. And so they form a complete complete set of basis vectors for the Hilbert space. Great. Yes. Yes. Yep. Yes.
Can I just check, is K discrete?
It is discrete here, so we've got a finite volume.
Oh, so we're considering the modes in a finite
volume. Yeah, yeah. So if you want to talk about continuous functions, then you can take the volume to infinity, and then you get a continuous set of vectors. But they're a lot more difficult to work with in practice. Excitement and you get those sort of states. Okay, so we saw that the number states form a complete basis for the electromagnetic field. Another basis for the field is the coherent state basis, which I will define now. So coherent states are interesting because they've got an indefinite number of photons. So these Fock states, they, you know, you can say that an n-photon Fock state has n-photons, but coherent states are in the superposition of different Fock states. And so this allows them to have one second.
Why are they coherent then?
So they are coherent. So the terminology comes from Glauber, who won the Nobel Prize for quantum optics. So in the 60s, he introduced these coherent states, and they satisfy the property that all of the correlation functions, like up to, you know, so the nth correlation function up to n equals infinity, they will factorize into products of first order correlation functions. And so they're coherent in that sense. And, yeah, so the correlation functions talk about the degree of coherence, so the terminology kind of comes from there. But you'll also see that they are a coherent superposition of Fock states, so you could also argue that they're coherent in that sense. Okay, so the thing about the coherent states is that, I'll say it later when we get to the Wigner functions, actually. Okay, so mathematically, they're most easily generated using what's called the displacement operator. So I'll define that for you. So the displacement operators are defined like this, where alpha is an arbitrary complex number. And these things are really lovely. If you ever end up doing calculations in quantum optics, just knowing that they satisfy a couple of properties makes life so much easier. So the properties that end up being useful are as follows. Okay, so the Hermitian conjugate of the operator is its inverse, and it's equal to a displacement in the opposite direction. So that kind of makes sense. If I displace something one way and I displace it back, then it's kind of the opposite operation. And so this implies that the operators are unitary, and they give you the identity when you apply them or undo them. And when you sandwich annihilation operator between them, you get the annihilation operator back, and then you add a constant corresponding to the amplitude, this parameter alpha inside the displacement operator. So this, I'm giving you this just because it comes in useful like in upcoming calculations. And then there's an equivalent one for the A dagger, where you get a dagger here and the complex conjugate. So then the coherent state is defined as acting the displacement operator on the vacuum state. And so coherent states are are eigenstates of the annihilation operator. So if we act the annihilation operator on alpha, you get back the eigenvalue alpha and the state again. So this is an important property. And I'll just show you how you can quickly prove that using these nice properties of the displacement operator. So we have an annihilation operator acting on the coherent state. We can just insert the identity. So here I've just put in the identity and the definition of the coherent state. And then we can use this nice expression for the annihilation operator sandwiched between the displacement operators. It'll give me A plus alpha. So then we can write D of alpha times alpha, let's see. So I'll put this up if you guys can't see from there. But we've got the annihilation operator acting on the vacuum, so that term just goes to zero, and we're left with alpha displacement operator alpha acting on vacuum, which gives us back alpha ket alpha. And we can expand these guys in the Fock bases. And so you can see that these guys are, it's a superposition of many different photon number states. And we can calculate the probability distribution of the state being in any particular number state. And so we can, inside here we have alpha mod squared, which corresponds to the mean photon number in that state. So if we were to draw this distribution, let's say as a function of n, I mean, it would be discrete for starters. It'll be kind of something like that for a small coherent state. And then, you know, for a larger coherent state, it might look something like that. And then, you know, as the coherent state gets larger and larger, we'll get something that kind of starts to approximate a Gaussian distribution. So the states, I'm just telling you a few other properties. So these states, they're not orthogonal. For different values of alpha, but we can write down the overlap between these states. like that. And so as long as, well, let's see. So as long as the difference between, you know, the two different amplitudes is greater than one, then you can approximate these states as being orthogonal. But in general, they have some sort of non-zero overlap for different alpha and beta. And so the reason these things are useful in quantum optics is they are a very good representation of the state of a laser that's operating above threshold. So do you have, no? So we can use these coherence states. I don't want to use the terminology that they're classical states, but we can use them as the quantum representation of states that we're used to thinking about classically. So, for example, the laser. And so one way to see that is we can calculate the expectation value of the electric field with respect to one of these states, alpha. So we'll take the expectation value of the electric field. And we get back essentially what we had over there, except that all of the creation operators have been just replaced with classical amplitudes. And so hopefully you can see for like nice values of you know, if you pick some sort of, let's say a plane wave for one of these mode functions, then this thing here plus its complex conjugate will give you something that looks like, you know, cosine omega t minus k dot r. So it represents the, with some sort of, you know, complex coefficient. So it represents the classical way that we think about electromagnetic fields. And what I didn't mention also is that even though these things are not orthogonal, they can still be used as a basis to decompose the electromagnetic field. It's just an overcomplete basis because of the lack of orthogonality. So we have, let's just say, can be used as a basis. And so we have the completeness relation as follows. So now we're going to integrate over the complex parameter alpha, and we have an outer product of coherent states, which gives us the identity. Okay, so we've got Fock states, we have coherent states, and I just want to cover two more interesting states of light, which are the squeeze states and also these Schrodinger cat states. So something I didn't, mention earlier when we were discussing coherent states is that these coherent states are what we call minimum uncertainty states. So I'll kind of explain what I mean by that in a second. Here, do I want to explain it now? I haven't really defined operator yet. But if we think about, let's say, like the position and momentum of the coherent state, then the uncertainty in one of these parameters is going to be, the product of the uncertainties in the position and momentum are going to satisfy the minimum possible value given by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And so that's true for coherent states, but there's like a wider general class of states that satisfy the minimum uncertainty relation. And the way that they do that is they reduce the uncertainty in, let's say the position compared with the coherent state, but they do this at the expense of increasing the uncertainty in, momentum, for example. But in quantum optics, we don't really talk about position and momentum so much. We talk about these other operators called the quadrature operators. And so I'm going to just introduce them now, and then hopefully what I just said will become a little bit more clear. So we can write these operators A and A dagger in terms of these two Hermitian operators, which I said we call quadratures. And these operators satisfy the following commutation relations.
Should there not be I on X2 or something?
They satisfy these commutators, and they have an uncertainty relation. Where the product of the square root of the variances is greater than or equal to 1. And so for the coherent states, we have that delta x1 is equal to delta x2 is equal to 1. But there are also other ways that you can satisfy the equality in this equation. So just to give you a little bit of an intuition for what's going on, we draw these things called phase space diagrams, where I have the quadrature on one axis and then the other quadrature on the other axis, and a coherent state would be represented by something like this. So the imaginary and real components of this parameter alpha give you the coordinates. And then you have this region, which, turns out to be Gaussian, but you can define a circle to represent the Gaussian. And then we have the widths of these Gaussians given by these square roots of variances. And so you can see now that the reason that these states are called squeeze states is because we can squeeze them in one quadrature, but at the expense of increasing the noise in the other quadrature. And so the reason this can be useful in practice is that you can do experiments that are only sensitive to one of these quadratures, and this can help you do measurements in a much more precise way than you could do with like standard classical states of light. So for example, these things were popularized a couple of decades ago to be used in, you know, interferometers like LIGO, for example, to detect the presence of gravitational waves. So they're thinking of using these type of non-classical states of light there. Okay, so the squeeze states satisfy those properties, but we haven't really defined what they are. And in an analogous way to where the coherent states were defined in terms of this displacement operator, we define the squeeze states in terms of a squeezing operator. S of epsilon is equal to minus a half epsilon star a squared minus epsilon a dagger squared. So epsilon is a complex parameter that defines how much squeezing there is. So the magnitude of epsilon defines how much you squeeze the state, and the phase of the complex part of the phase part of epsilon defines the axis along which you squeeze. And so then we can write a squeeze state. In terms of the amplitude alpha and the amount of squeezing. And so typically what you do is you first squeeze the vacuum state, and then you displace it to some sort of position on the phase space diagram. Yes?
Sorry to go backwards, but that inner product...
Sorry, let me just turn this off. Yeah, ask your question.
The inner product of beta and alpha.
Mm-hmm.
I think the exponent should be alpha squared plus beta squared minus 2 alpha beta star.
That seems correct. Did you just calculate that or Google it?
You can get it from...
I can probably see it from there. Yeah.
And then it makes sense why
yep.
the alpha minus beta
yep.
should be.
Excellent. Thanks. Sorry, I just want to turn this off. Okay, now we come to cat states, which are my favorite states, because they make really beautiful Wigner function plots. So, yesterday Joe was talking about Schrodinger's Gedanken experiment of, you know, having this macroscopic superposition of two classical states, so the cat being dead and the cat being alive. And so here, people use this awful terminology of calling coherent states the classical, most classical quantum state that you have. But we saw that you can use it to represent, you know, some sort of macroscopic thing like the laser. And so you can imagine if I now take two distinct states of the laser and I create a coherent superposition of them, then I would be able to write down a state that you could argue is a... superposition of two macroscopic states. So let's write this down. He was like waiting for me to turn around to leave. I didn't even write them down on here. Okay. Oh, okay, here we go. Okay, so we have this coherent superposition of two different coherent states. So they have the same amplitude in this case, but they have a different phase. And so looking at the overlap there, you can see that as alpha gets bigger, then, okay, no, I don't want to talk about Wigner functions yet, but like as alpha gets bigger, then the overlap between these states is going to get smaller and smaller, and the states themselves are going to become more and more macroscopic in a sense. And so we can properly normalize these guys. And we also typically think about this other superposition of coherent states with a minus sign. And we usually call this guy an even cat, and this guy an odd cat. And I'll show you why in a second. But let's just define this normalization parameter. Who wants to guess why they're called even cat and odd cat? That's a good guess. That's not why.
There's symmetric and anti-symmetric, but if you exchange alpha and minus alpha.
Yeah, is
it's
it
pretty
the
good.
Properties under the d alpha operator?
Even cats contain even alpha.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this guy knows. So these are all really good answers, but the reason people talk about them in terms of even cat and odd cat is if you write them down in the photon number basis. So somewhere here, I guess we had a decomposition. Oh, here. If you add this guy to itself with a different phase, you see that this minus sign will be inside here, so you'll get you'll get rid of the minus every time n is an odd number, and you'll keep the minus every time. Sorry, you'll get rid of the minus when n is an even number, and you'll keep the minus when n is an odd number. So when you're adding them together, all of the odd number states disappear, and so you're only left with a state that has even photon number states. And the other way around, if you subtract them, then you're only left with a state that has odd photon number states. So we can decompose this I'll just write it out explicitly, like what it looks like. So you can see this guy only has odd, even photon numbers, and this one only has odd photon numbers. And it turns out that these states are really, really difficult to make experimentally. And so this might be surprising, because I was before talking about how if you get two different lasers with different phases and you create a coherent superposition, you should be able to, well, if I create mathematically a coherent superposition, I'll get a cat state. And so you can imagine in a lab, I'm just going to get two different lasers and I shine them, you know, on top of each other or something. Somehow I should be able to construct this. But unfortunately, if you do that, you get a different type of state. Does someone want to take a guess at what sort of state you would get? Who said that? Yes, a mixed state, exactly. So if we just shine two laser beams, I won't finish writing, but on top of each other, then you get a state that's a mixed state that looks something like this. So these states, I mean, they haven't been realized in the lab yet, but what people have made is very, very good approximations to these states for small alpha. And so when we look at the Wigner functions again, I'll explain to you a little bit about how they actually manufacture them in the lab. And so the reason CAD states are interesting is because they're useful for quantum computational tasks. So you can encode your zeros and ones instead of encoding them in, you know, discrete things like photon number. You can encode them into you know, states like alpha and minus alpha. And as long as, you know, alpha and minus alpha are sufficiently large, then the overlap is going to be small, and you can think of them as orthogonal states. But it turns out that you can actually do a bunch of quantum computational tasks even for small alpha, but, you know, that's kind of beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. Okay, great. So now I will tell you a little bit about the Wigner function, which is the function that we saw in the movie. And then I have a Mathematica notebook, which I'll show you. We can kind of play around with the different Wigner functions. And so we'll have a look how the functions look for all of these states. Okay, so now I'm going to do a Joe, and I'm going to change notation in the middle of the lecture. But at least I'm going to tell you about it in advance. So because I have a different set of lecture notes on this stuff, and I thought I'd better just be consistent with the notes so I don't make typos as I'm transcribing. So for this thing, I'm going to take x1 to little x and x2 to y. Okay, so we've seen in the whole course that you can represent quantum states using density matrices. And so Wigner functions are an alternate way to represent quantum states. So if you have, I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence between a density matrix and a Wigner function. And once you have a Wigner function, you can do everything that you want to do, you know, propagate the state and so on. In many situations, it might be more difficult to actually do calculations with Wigner functions, but you know, you can if you want to. So let's just for a moment think about a classical situation. So these functions are in some sense analogous to classical probability distributions. And so if I take, you know, some sort of classical harmonic oscillator, I can represent it as a point in my phase space diagram. And then, you know, I can have some sort of distribution of classical states, and we can think about these as some sort of, you know, probability distribution P of x, y. So P of x, y is a probability distribution. And since it's a probability distribution, it satisfies the properties that it is always greater than or equal to 0 for all x, y. And because we want all of our probabilities to sum to 1, we're going to have the condition that the integral over P of x and y is going to be equal to 1. And if we just measure one coordinate, then we get the marginal probability distributions, which are probability of x. We integrate out y. And similarly for probability of y, we integrate out x. So this gives us the probability distributions along, you know, one axis. Okay, but in quantum mechanics, we can't precisely measure, you know, two different observables that are non-commuting. And so it doesn't make sense to talk about probability distributions of, you know, joint probability distributions of these two observables. And so what we do is we define what's called a quasi-probability distribution, which is this Wigner function. And the Wigner function satisfies some similar properties to these probability distributions, but it doesn't satisfy all of them. And I'll show you which ones that is. So actually, judging from the pictures that we saw, like, what's the most obvious thing that the Wigner function is not going to satisfy? Yeah, not positive everywhere. So let's call this thing W of x and y. I guess since we're kind of running short on time, I'm not going to rewrite all of these properties. You can define the marginals in a similar way. Just replace the P with a W. And so the marginals actually turn out to satisfy the property that they are always greater than or equal to 1. So as long as we're measuring just one of these observables, then it's OK. It's only when we try to measure two of them at the same time that we come into trouble. So Wigner function satisfies these properties, and it satisfies the property that it's normalized. So if you integrate W of x and y, you get 1, but it does not satisfy this property. Okay. And the way that usually people define the Wigner function is in terms of a Fourier transform of something that's known as the characteristic function. So let's write this down. Where the characteristic function is given by... So trace of rho, where rho is your density matrix, 1 second, times the displacement operator. Yes?
The normalization of the Wigner function, is it like normalized in norm, or in like absolute value, or is it?
No, so you can see that. Well, from what I said, if you integrate out one of the quadratures, then you're going to be left with a function that's positive everywhere. So then that positive function, when you integrate that out, you're going to get a positive number that's equal to 1. So it's not the norm of it or anything. It's actually the Wigner function. Okay. So eta here is a complex number. So I wanted to derive the Wigner function for the coherent state for you, but I feel like maybe we started at 5-2, right? So I can go for another 15 minutes. Is that right? Yeah, 15 minutes. So maybe I will.
You also have tutorial.
Yeah, okay, so good. You're doing my job. I usually tell Joe, don't do this now. But now you're telling me we can do it in tutorials. So okay, good. we won't do it now. Okay, so we won't derive it, but I'll just write it down for you. Okay, so we have the characteristic function chi, which depends on the density matrix of our state, times the displacement operator, and then we take the trace of this. And then we, there should be an integral, oh my. And then we take a two-dimensional Fourier transform of the characteristic function with respect to these the complex parameters, complex and well, the complex number eta, and then we get something that's a function of beta, which is just our x and our y. So you can imagine going through this process, and you get some sort of function that you can then plot as a function of x and y. So now I think I will like to show you some of the Wigner functions. And so Max, could I please get the screen?
Stand by.
Is everyone going to go and see Max's play? It starts this weekend. Yes, everyone says yes.
What?
Yeah, it should say Aggie. Who's Christy? Max, who's Christy? Okay, so hopefully in yesterday's tutorial, you were all impressed with the manipulate function, because it's really cool. And so here what we have is a Wigner function for a coherent state. And so I can mess around with the parameters x and y and move this guy around. So that's nice. I can draw the Wigner function for the Fock states. And so you can see here, okay, with the coherent state, if you imagine, can you see what I'm doing? Oh, good. Okay, if you imagine in the middle is the origin, then the coherent state is displaced. And so there's some sort of notion of a phase that defines where around the origin you are. So this thing has, it's got an undefined photon number, but it has a well-defined phase. On the other hand, if we look at a Fock state, it's completely symmetric around the origin. And so it's got a well-defined photon number, but a completely undefined phase. So there's this sort of uncertainty relationship between the photon number and the phase of a state. So yeah, we can look at different Fock states. They take a little while to run. Okay, so, and you can see as like n increases, then you get more and more ripples.
So rendering your big ripple in the movie took a bit then?
It took a long, yeah, and I had a computer that was 6 years older than this, so imagine that. So actually, so this computer is like 4 years old, and it was running beautifully like the whole time until I upgraded to like the new operating system, and now it just like takes ages. Anyway, okay, yeah, so you can see more ripples like for the n equals 7 Fock state. And so I don't know whether you noticed with the other one, but the peak was in the middle, so the peak like oscillates, you know, up or down depending on the odd or even number. Okay, so we have coherent states that we can squeeze. So I can move this guy over, and I can, you know, squeeze, increase the squeezing parameter, and I get that. Okay, we can also, I didn't do the math for this, but we don't have to just squeeze coherent states, we can squeeze all states. So for example, this thing is a Fock state, a single photon Fock state, and we can squeeze that as well. And so it looks something like this. Okay, so I'm going to pick a specific value on purpose. Let's go with that. Okay, great. Then we saw we can have coherent superpositions of cat states. And so here now I have like this guy corresponds to the alpha equals 2 cat state, and that's the alpha equals minus 2 cat state. And you see that you get these ripples in the middle that correspond to the coherences between the odd cat and the even cat. So these are, that's kind of like the non-classical part of the state. So something that I didn't mention about the Wigner function earlier is that it's not always positive. And so typically people kind of use this rule of thumb that the negativity of the Wigner function is a sign of non-classicality of a state. So the squeeze states and the coherent states are Gaussian states, and they're all positive, so people sometimes think that they're, you know, more classical. But if you get states like the Fock states, which really dip below zero, or these superpositions of cat states, which also dip below zero, then that's, you know, a sign of the fact that they're quantum mechanical states rather than just classical ones. And so, yeah, what I wanted to contrast that with is if I just took a incoherent mixture, like we had there, you know, shining the two lasers on top of each other, we get this incoherent mixture of cat states. Then we get these two peaks, but we don't get these interference fringes in the middle, so there's no coherence there, and these are all positive now. Okay, so I was saying earlier that these cat states are really difficult to make in the lab, but one thing that people do is make kitten states, so they're cat states for very, very small alpha. And so let's have a look at, let's decrease, so I have it as beta here, but beta is alpha. Okay, so so you can see that this, like what's happened is that the interference fringes kind of got further apart and the peaks got closer together, and you get something that looks very much like a squeezed photon state. So if we go back to this guy. And so if you calculate the fidelity, or like the overlap between these two states, it's actually very, very high. And it still has you know, these non-classical properties, and you can use it instead of cat states, you can use these squeezed single photon states in order to do, you know, quantum computational tasks. So that's very nice. So I guess it's sort of a little bit convincing with the Wigner function. But in reality, I mean, if you wanted to take an actual single photon, like to make that is like really, really difficult in the first place. And then to squeeze it, that would be really difficult as well. So even though mathematically we can see that the kitten state is like a squeezed single photon state, physically what you do is something like this. So let me just write something down first. Oh, I didn't show you how squeeze states act on annihilation operators, so this won't be so impressive. But anyway, you can see the derivation. Okay, so let me work you through it. So what I have here is a squeezed vacuum state, and I'm annihilating a photon from that, right? So then I do a similar thing that I did before where I insert the identity, because these squeezing operators are unitary operators. And I also, well, I keep the squeeze state acting on the vacuum. And then we have, like, I gave you a nice expression for how the displacement operators act on the annihilation operator. There's a similar expression for how squeezing operators act on the annihilation operator. And so this thing here gives you something that looks like that. So we have an annihilation operator times a Cauch term, and a creation operator times a Sinch term. And you can see that this guy, this operator acting on the vacuum state, will just destroy that term. And so you're left with something that's the squeezing operator times a dagger times zero, and it's now renormalized for mysterious reasons. and so then you're left with something that's a creation operator acting on the vacuum, so that's a single photon, and the squeezing operator. So a squeezed single photon, which looks like a small kitten state, is actually a photon subtracted squeezed vacuum state. And so squeezed vacuum states are easy to make. You just like get a nonlinear crystal and you shine a laser at the nonlinear crystal, and the thing that comes out is a squeezed vacuum state. So you get your, you've got your nonlinear crystal, you shine just a normal laser beam, and then what comes out is your squeezed vacuum state. And then they get a beam splitter that's very weakly reflecting, and so some of the beam gets reflected here, and they have a single photon detector that sits here and waits. And when that detector goes click and says, I've detected a single photon, then we know that the state that's left in here is going to be your photon subtracted squeezed vacuum state. And so then this thing here is going to approximate an odd kitten state for alpha, you know, like less than 2 approximately. And so experimentally, like people actually make these and then they use them like to show, you know, interesting quantum information things. Okay, so that's all I wanted to tell you. And now just let me play the movie again with the music. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it.
Aggie?
Yes.
What was your PhD research on?
Some of it was to do with using these squeezed, these kitten states and showing how to do teleportation in, you know, the coherent state basis. And then a lot of it also was on how to design like properties of these nonlinear crystals in order to achieve certain things, and describing also like the states that come out. And, yeah. So I have a friend who refers to this as Experi theory. So my PhD was in quantum optics Experi theory. Let's do. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know why the sound wasn't playing. Maybe you'll just hear it from my computer. Oh wait, let's make it bigger. There might actually be like copyright issues about this being put online. Pardon? Okay. Yeah, it is, isn't it? I don't know what people are talking about. Okay, yeah, so this band is awesome. They're from Brisbane, my hometown, and also where Tom went to for honors. So they're called Regurgitator. You should check them out. Okay, so thanks. And yeah, so the class today at 3:30, it's not compulsory, but I can answer questions about the homeworks 2 and 3 if you have any questions. So I'll see you then.